Again, being Mother's Day, I'm sure many of you have places you're going to be this afternoon to celebrate that. And so I want to keep things moving here today pretty briskly. But by way of introduction, I do want to clarify something that I said last week, because I meant what I meant, but I'm not sure I said what I meant. And in reflection, which I sometimes reflect, I thought, you know, I'm not really sure that was terribly clear. And I don't remember if the context would have made it clear. And besides, even if it did, you know, we all understand things different ways. We all use the same English vocabulary radically differently, you know. And so I thought it probably would bear clarification. Because again, I'm not apologizing for what I meant, but I'm not sure if I said it the way I meant it. And it makes a difference. It makes an awful difference. I said last week, if you've got those church hurts, you've been burned at church somehow, I was speaking in the context of us using those things as those are things that we need to leave behind. And I was speaking in the context of using those hurts that we've experienced at church as an excuse to avoid present opportunities to serve the kingdom. And what I said was, if you've been previously burned at church, I really don't care. What I meant was, I do not care to hear that used as an excuse to not serve God in the present. I did not mean, if you are currently experiencing a church hurt, I don't care. I specifically do care, you know? If we go through those difficult relationships in the church family, I do care. If it is something that has happened in the past and it remains an excuse for not to serve God in the present, then the only thing I care about is the fact that you're living in sin, because that's holding a grudge and you're really not supposed to do that, you know? So really, what I really care about is the present more than the past. And sometimes our past hurts become excuses for not serving in the present. And that's what I was trying to drive at, is there's no place for excuses. And there's no place for excuses, even if they seem justified in our own minds. Oh, I've been hurt. Well, and God heals. So your point was, right? Because God heals, and when he heals and restores, he restores us to usefulness, because that is exactly the point of restoration. So if you've been burned in a church environment, it doesn't mean I don't care if it's happening now. But if it's some months or years in the past, isn't it just blasphemy to use it as an excuse to not serve in the present, because what you're saying is that you have a hurt God is incapable of healing? So, by way of clarification, whatever I may have said last week, that's what I meant. Sometimes when something simmers for a long time, what happens, right? The water leaves it. So it becomes a little thicker and a little more condensed and a little stronger. So what I spit out last week was the solid form of something that had been congealing for some time, simmering in my mind. And then I realized that, you know, once the water's been evaporated out, sometimes things come out maybe more strongly and less clearly, right? I like saying things strongly because I think it provides clarity, but if you're going to say something strongly and you even just slightly miss the mark, it has the opposite effect of providing clarity. It provides more confusion. So I thought that it bore clarification this morning. I didn't make that decision in a vacuum. I thought about it later. And I thought, you know, maybe that wasn't clear exactly what I meant. And so I asked, and someone said, yeah, probably that bears clarification. So there we have it. That your past hurts are not a reason to avoid present opportunity. It's just an excuse. And opportunity is what I want to talk about this morning. So that's where we somewhat roughly segue. If you'll turn to 2 Kings chapter 4. We don't often, at least I've never heard of it, honestly. I'm not saying that no one ever does it, but I've never heard of anyone doing it. We don't often think through parenthood all that well before we do it, all right? We rush into parenthood for, you know, any number of reasons, and usually the number of reasons is pretty small, all right? We don't often really think it over, and we have no clue, you know, what it's really going to be like. And then once we have children and everything we thought was our parents' fault, we then realize it's our children's fault now. You got to find somebody to blame other than you, right, for all your problems. You know, and we enter into the complexity of a family relationship, but on the other side of the wall, you know. And then we see, to some extent, what our parents went through. And do you ever want to go back and apologize and then think, but wait a minute, I didn't ask to get born, right? And you wonder, was I my fault the way I was? Because I was the way I was. I mean, no lying about that, you know? And then we experience all that on the other side, you know, as parents. And I think we don't see going in, we have no clue what it's going to be like because it's one of those things that can never sufficiently be explained. Like most things that totally change your identity, it really can't be explained until it's experienced. The Christian life is something, it's an entire shift in your identity, and so it really can't be explained. It can be described. Marriage is the same way. It can't really be explained. It can't be sufficiently, you know, pictured in your mind until you're there. And then you realize what everybody was trying to tell you all along. And parenthood, the same. And the things that you can sort of guess at, and then you're in it. And then it ain't guessing anymore, and it's not a game. And it gets pretty serious. And I think we have no idea, as we enter into parenthood, what it's really going to be like, or what the opportunity is that arises. And there are at least three things I want to discuss this morning. This is in regard to motherhood specifically, in regard to parenthood by extrapolation, and more generally, in regard to anything in life that really demands a lot out of you. So there's a couple of principles I want to look at this morning from 2 Kings chapter 4. They have to do, you can see these things are applicable to any situation in life that deeply changes you, that demands a lot of you. And that's the first point I want to make, is that these situations in life that demands a lot out of you, and nobody would say that parenthood isn't demanding, none of these things that demand anything, you know, great amounts out of you end up leaving you the same. Right, you change, right, and you change pretty radically, or at least you certainly should oughta, because the person you were when you were not a parent was not yet capable of being a good one, because you'd never done it before, and it cannot be sufficiently explained, and therefore cannot be sufficiently prepared for. So if parenthood doesn't change you, I tell you, you're doing it wrong, right? And I don't know too much about too many things, but I know that these things that are greatly demanding on you will change you. And that's what we want to look at today. These are opportunities for change. Parenthood is an opportunity for change. Motherhood is an opportunity for change. The Christian walk is an opportunity for change. And anything that you go through that takes a lot out of you, what it gives you in return, changes you fundamentally. 2 Kings chapter 4, verses 1 through 7. A certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets cried out to Elisha, saying, "Your servant, my husband, is dead. And you know that your servant feared the Lord. And the creditor is coming to take my two sons to be his slaves." So Elisha said to her, "What shall I do for you? Tell me, what do you have in the house?" And she said, "Well, your maidservant has nothing in the house but a jar of oil." And he said, "Go and borrow vessels from everywhere, from all your neighbors, empty vessels. Do not gather just a few. And when you have come in, you shall shut the door behind you and your sons and pour it into all those vessels and set aside the full ones." So she went from him and shut the door behind her and her sons, who brought the vessels to her, and she poured it out. Now it came to pass when the vessels were full that she said to her son, "Bring me another vessel." And he said to her, "There isn't one." And the oil ceased. And she came and told the man of God, and he said, "Go, sell the oil, pay your debt, and you and your sons live on the rest." And I suppose there's probably 6 or 8 different lessons that we can pull from this passage about probably as many different subjects. But this morning, obviously, this is a story about a mother, and it's a story about a mother in a real bad way. She's not only widowed, but she is the mother of presumably somewhat young-ish sons, based on the fact that they are not married with homes of their own at this point. All right, so she is a mother of sons at home, and she is a mother probably without—they're probably not her last children, but her only children. All right, because she has nowhere else to go. All right, it is evident that she has no grown children at this point. At least they're certainly not part of the picture. And so the basic assumption here is that she is a young widow of children, a mother of children at home. And not only is she widowed, but she is obviously poverty-stricken, and also they are already in debt. The creditor is coming, and he's going to take her sons to be slaves, and in so doing, eventually pay off the debt, while leaving her really no help around the house to grow even their own food, which would be, you know, pretty customary to produce your own food like it is in many places in the world today, and was for most people throughout, you know, the bulk of human history. You just got to realize how differently we do things. So her husband, though, who has passed away and left her a widow, was one of the sons of the prophets, a school of ministry professionals, right? These people are serious about following God, and they're doing so under basically the leadership of Elisha and before him Elijah, and that's why she says, "Your servant, my husband, is dead." And they're doing so in the context of religious turmoil. You remember Elijah does some pretty flamboyant things, and including some executions of the prophets of Baal, and the whole scenario is pretty flamboyant, and that's kind of the kind of guy Elisha is. And yet, out of all the good that he's doing in the nation of Israel, he still wishes that God would, at one point, would take his life. He said, "I'm sick of this because I'm getting nowhere. All this work, I am exhausted in the proclamation that you are the true and living and only God. And after all this, Jezebel is still out to kill me. The message didn't take, you know." And yet, God restores his confidence and his courage in God himself, and reminds him that there are people that Elijah doesn't even know about that are serving God. Elijah is maybe a little bit preoccupied with the leadership of the nation and how they are apostate, because certainly that is dragging down the rest of his country, who are supposed to be the covenant people of God, and they're not even worshiping him hardly at all. So it is in this setting of social and religious turmoil, which continued in the nation of Israel until eventually they're taken into captivity, that Elisha is sort of presiding over the school of the sons of the prophets. And so it is not necessarily likely that this young widow will be able to remarry someone who is also a fellow worshiper of Jehovah. She may not have that many options. There are already children. She already has two sons who are therefore able to eventually, when they're adults, inherit land to their father's name. So she is not really, there's really no obligation on any of the relations of her family to marry her and raise an inheritance so that her husband's name doesn't die out in the nation, like we see in the story of Ruth and Boaz. So she really doesn't have a lot of options. And she is indebted, and she is widowed. Does this sound like a situation that's going to take a lot out of you? Yeah. What is her recourse? She goes to Elisha. Why does she go to Elisha? Elisha has already done some remarkable things as a servant of Elijah. Elijah has ascended into heaven not long hence in the book. And Elijah did a number of incredible things. And so really, the most rational thing she can do is go right to the power source. Right? This is the cause that her husband was living for, and this man is at least reportedly, and probably she believes it as well, the man of God, the prophet of Israel. And if anybody can help, it's this guy. So out of everyone in the nation of Israel who is following after Baal and all the other false gods of the Canaanites and the Philistines, this woman goes to Elisha. And I would just like to suggest to you this morning, again, we want to keep moving here, that the demanding and sometimes inescapable demands of parenthood are an opportunity to demonstrate that God has been changing you. Not only will parenthood produce that change, but it produces you gives you an incredible stage. Parenthood and the relationships of parenthood and the relationships with your children, the relationships of you to society as you raise your children in the public eye. None of us are an island, right? It is a stage on which God can display what he has been doing in you. And where we go when the chips are down, when we're between a rock and a hard place, who we expect to pull us out of that hard place, when we're in the miry clay of life, who do we wait patiently for? And we will have those opportunities as parents to make that decision. Where do I put my hope in this situation? Who am I trusting in this situation? When we are in all of the catch-22s in life, who has the answers? Who has the solutions? Who do we trust? And if your hope is in God, that is an unnatural thing. Salvation is a supernatural thing. It's not a natural thing. And so we can demonstrate, we have the opportunity as parents to demonstrate that we have a supernatural mindset, that we have an unnatural mindset, that we are called to serve greater purposes, and so we follow a greater God. And parenthood and its demands and all of its worst and stickiest situations are an opportunity for us to demonstrate that God has been changing us all along. What he's been doing in us that maybe has not been clear to us at the time, and maybe only incrementally clear to the people who observe us, when we get in those situations where parenthood really puts the pressure on us, we have an incredible opportunity to display, to demonstrate on the stage of our lives what God has been doing in our hearts. Now, in this story, obviously, it has a pretty good ending. I won't say it has a great ending. Her husband's still dead. But it has a pretty good ending. She gets out of the jam that she's in. She's not only able to pay off the creditor and keep the sons around that she is going to need to rely on, but also has some surplus. He says, you and your sons live on the rest. So she's out of a jam. She's out of a hard place. She's out of the load of that debt, and also has some surplus to kind of grease the wheels of life going forward. Under the circumstances, it's a pretty good ending. Does parenthood always have those kind of endings? Well, that would be nice. So when the ending isn't this tidy, where's your hope? And we are still faced in all the aspects of parenthood and all the challenges of parenthood, we are still faced with an incredible opportunity. The opportunity to demonstrate how God has changed us. Now it happened one day that Elisha went to Shunem, where there was a notable woman, and she persuaded him to eat some food. So it was, as often as he passed by, he would turn in there to eat some food. And she said to her husband, look now, I know that this is a holy man of God who passes by us regularly. Please, let us make a small upper room on the wall, and let us put a bed for him there, and a table, and a chair, and a lampstand, so it will be whenever he comes to us that he can turn in there, and making a convenient stop along the way for Elisha. And it happened one day that he came by there, and he turned in the upper room and lay down there, and he said to Gehazi's servant, call the Shunammite woman. And when he had called her, he stood before her, and he said to him, say now to her, look, you have been concerned for us with all this care. What can I do for you? Do you want me to speak on your behalf to the king or to the commander of the army? Elisha is a pretty well-known guy. Is there any way in which, you know, this is, as it turns out, a reasonably substantial family. She is a notable woman, all right? So it may be that with their somewhat elevated social position, they may have somewhat elevated social enemies. Is there some way someone I can go to on your behalf? Do you have any issues I can help, you know, smooth over with, you know, with Elisha's degree of prophetic influence? Shall I speak to the king? Shall I speak to the commander of the army? Is there somebody that I can talk to for you? Is there something that you need? She says, I dwell among my own people. I pretty much have it made. I dwell among my own people. I'm at peace among my own people. And he says, well, what's to be done for her? You know, he's like, she has extended tremendous hospitality toward Elisha and his servant Gehazi. And so he asks, you know, if there's really nothing that comes to mind for her, what can we think of, you know, to do for this woman and her family? And Gehazi said, well, actually, she has no son and her husband is old. And he said, call her. Excuse me. And when he had called her, she stood in the doorway, and he said to her, about this time next year you shall embrace a son. And she says, no, my Lord, man of God, do not lie to your maidservant. Thank you. But the woman conceived and bore a son when the appointed time had come, of which Elijah had told her. And the child grew. Well, good. That's the way it's supposed to go. So far, so good. First, somewhat miraculous birth, and secondly, the child is well. The child grew. I got to tell you, a fellow I worked with for a while, all of his children are grown now. Some are married. He's got grandchildren. But at one point, he had a son who was quite ill early in life, and he said to me, Alden, if your kids are healthy, you're a millionaire. You know, that alone. And so this woman, she has this son, and the child grew. So far, so good. And in fact, pretty great. We can assume that she may have been starting to lose hope, all right, that this situation would ever take place, because after all, as Gehazi observes, well, she doesn't have a son, and her husband's kind of getting up there. She has the son, and the child grew. And now it happened one day, he went out to his father, to the reapers. Hey, even better. The kid's getting to the point where he can follow dad around the field, and he's going to start to learn things. I do not know why I am so completely overcome anytime I talk about kids learning things. They're going to learn whether you like it or not. The question is who they're learning from. They're going to learn something. We all do. We all grow into life as we go into life. They're going to learn. And this kid has it pretty good. He's got a prophet who comes by the house on the regular. He's at the age now where his father, who is apparently successful to some extent, he can go out with his father and begin to just to learn by observation. As they say, more is caught than taught. Begin to learn by observation the things that he will need to know. He may need to know these things in order to care for his mother eventually, because Gehazi does not say she has no son and she is old. She has no son and her husband is old. She may be somewhat younger. She may outlive him, and this son's ability to follow in after his father and care for, obviously they farm on some scale, went out to his father to the reapers, all right? His ability to manage the reapers is going to be important for his mother's welfare as well. And he said to his father, "My head, my head." So he said to his servant, "Carry him to his mother." Rational thing to do. I'm out here with the servants. We're reaping. You know, you don't plant too many trees in the middle of a cornfield, right? Not a lot of shade. If you're reaping, by definition, there's not a lot of shade, all right? He's probably just getting heat exhausted. Take him back in the house to his mother, and we'll finish the job. And when he had taken him and brought him to his mother, he sat on her knees till noon and then died. And she went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God, shut the door upon him, and went out. And she called to her husband and said, "Please send me one of the young men and one of the donkeys that I may run to the man of God and come back." And he said, "Why are you going to him today? It's neither the new moon nor the Sabbath." And she said, "All's well." She saddled the donkey and said to her servant, "Drive and go forward and do not slacken the pace for me unless I tell you." And so she departed and went to the man of God at Mount Carmel. And when the man of God saw her afar off, he said to his servant Gehazi, "Look, the Shunammite woman, please run now to meet her and say to her, 'Is it well with you? Is it well with your husband? Is it well with the child?'" And she answered, "It is well." Now when she came to the man of God at the hill, she caught him by the feet. But Gehazi came near to push her away. He said, What's the matter? You said everything was okay." And the man of God said, "Let her alone, for her soul is in deep distress, and the Lord has hidden it from me and has not told me." How many things as parents do we keep inside? I don't know. Almost everything? You know? How many things do you, as your children reveal, or as your children grow, how many things do we have the sense to reveal to them? You know, things that we've kept inside about how we evaluate our relationship to them, things we've kept inside for a long time because at certain ages they're not capable of absorbing it, you know? At what point do we begin treating them like adults? You know, at what point are we as open with them as we wish our parents had been with us? You know? Look back. You know? How good are we at learning from other people's mistakes? How good are we as we become parents at identifying which of our parents' mistakes, or so we thought, didn't actually turn out to be mistakes at all, and it's only because we're parents now that we understand why they did the things that they did? Pretty complex. But this woman has no desire to tell Elisha's servant what is on her mind. She doesn't tell the servant what is on her mind, although he may know. He may be the same one that carried the boy into the house, and that's why he's available and she calls him to saddle a donkey. She's going right to Elisha with this. "Did I ask a son of my Lord? Did I not say, 'Do not deceive me?'" Said, "A year from now you'll have a child." She said, "Oh, don't lie to me." "Well, now I've had one, and now he's grown. He's at least a couple of years. He's at least walking in the field following his father. And, you know, and he can talk. You know, my head, my head. I told you not to lie to me about having a son. If I lose him now, why did I have him in the first place? Did I ask you for this?" Right? I got to say, you know, we preach humility, and we ought to be cultivating humility, but do these really seem like unfair questions? At this point, her son's still dead. Again, we've read our Bibles. This story also has a nice ending. We already know that. But At this point, she doesn't. Is this an unfair question? I don't think it's an unfair question. You know, even the man of God may do something wrong. Elisha's a man of God, not God. She is not here necessarily questioning God, but questioning Elisha. So is this an unfair question? I don't really think it's an unfair question. You know, what would you do? And she goes to him, did I ask for this? Didn't I say don't deceive me? So obviously, she doesn't need to say much more. Something ain't right. So he said to Gehazi, get yourself ready, take my staff in your hand and be on your way. Gehazi probably is younger, and Elisha expects him to make tracks faster. Go ahead of me. If you meet anyone, don't greet him. If anyone greets you, don't even answer him. Get over there and lay my staff on the face of the child. And the mother of the child said, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, I will not leave you. So he arose and followed her, and Gehazi went on ahead of them. I laid the staff on the face of the child, but there was neither voice nor hearing. Therefore he went back to meet him and told him, saying, the child is not awakened. When Elisha came into the house, there was the child lying dead on his bed. And he went in therefore, shut the door behind the two of them, prayed to the Lord. He went up and lay on the child, put his mouth on his mouth, his eyes on his eyes, and his hands on his hands, and stretched himself out on the child, and the flesh of the child became warm. He returned, walked back and forth in the house, went up again, and stretched himself on him. And the child sneezed 7 times, and the child opened his eyes. And he called Gehazi and said, call the Shunammite woman. So he called her, and when she came in to him, he said, pick up your son. She went in, fell at his feet, bowed to the ground, and then picked up her son and went out. What changes do you think have taken place in this family? You know, what changes have taken place in their hearts? What changes have taken place in their thoughts about their future now that they have a child? Parenthood is an incredible opportunity. It's an opportunity to experience God changing you, an opportunity to demonstrate the change that's taken place. In both of these stories, I think we see two things. And so I understand this division is not particularly neat. But I think there are two things that we see in both of these stories. And that's what I would like us to see in both of them. That the parenthood and the demands of parenthood, it takes so much out of you, you will not be the same. The demands are so strong, you will not be the same, or you didn't do it right. Right? Again, I realize that when things simmer, they come out thick. But I'm going to tell you, you cannot remain the same or you didn't do it right. Parenthood takes a lot out of you, and you can see it as your children grow. You put so much into them, obviously, where are you getting it from to keep putting it into them? Well, there's one good source I can think of. And the strength that we need to have as parents, we get that from the source of all strength, from the strongest source there is, from the wisest source there is. And so we receive from God and dispense to our children in many areas of life. So if you have been receiving from God so that you can continue to invest in your children, all that you have received from God, will that not change you? All the wisdom you've been seeking, all the strength you've been seeking, I tell you, before you were a parent, you didn't have it. Right, there is nothing like parenthood to find out not only what you're made of, but what you could be made of. There's nothing like parenthood to find out how far you still have to go as a human. And nothing like parenthood to give you an opportunity to get there. There's nothing like parenthood to force change in you. And that's a good thing. Again, we all come into the world the same way. And we all come into the world in the same condition. Completely ignorant. And we go through massive changes in life as well as incremental changes in life, and all of them are an opportunity for us to learn and grow and learn and grow. And the incremental opportunities, some of them we even give labels. First grade, second grade, third grade, fourth grade, etc. But the massive changes, they come with their own labels. And we can call it parenthood, and that's our label for it, but it's God at work. It's God changing you, and God seeking to demonstrate through you the change that he is capable of producing in a human being. And I don't know, again, I say we don't really think through parenthood all that well. We just enter into parenthood. And then once we're there, we realize, wow, I have so much farther to go as a person. But we are in the very context that will help us get there, and in the very context that will reveal where we have gotten as a person. And we can look back at stresses in our own family background or whatever. You can look at your past however you want it. And those things are not an excuse for taking the opportunity that is presented to you. Parenthood is an incredible opportunity. It is an incredible gift. And the fact that it is one of just a couple of the most demanding things that really I can conceive of a person having to do does not mean that it is not the chance of a lifetime. Parenthood is the chance of a lifetime. It's a chance of a lifetime to see how much sleep deprivation your body can handle. It's the chance of a lifetime to see how far $1 will go before they ask for a second dollar. It's a chance of a lifetime for a lot of things that we say kind of tongue-in-cheek, even though they're all true, all right? All the jokes we make about being parents, they ain't jokes. That's why we make them, all right? We're complaining with a smile because it's all true. Parenthood is an incredible opportunity. And sometimes we are afraid of opportunities because we want good luck. Well, opportunity is luck dressed in work clothes. Opportunity is good luck's first day. And when we meet good luck by its first name, sometimes we're not too excited. Opportunity is pretty exciting. And when we're faced with that opportunity, to be earnest and intentional and deliberate parents, we're being faced with one of the most demanding challenges that I can think of. And it's a challenge that comes to millions worldwide every year. And some people enter into parenthood trying to remain as unchanged as possible. I've said before that I don't think we're all afraid of failure. I think too many of us are afraid of success. We don't want to be the people that God would like us to be because we're too accustomed to being the mediocre people that we already are or that we've always been, right? And in parenthood, you have the opportunity to leave that behind and to see how God will change you and how he will demonstrate through you what he is capable of changing in a person. Out of all of the gifts that we try to give our children, they, unintentionally, have given us an incredible gift. It's the opportunity to demonstrate in how we relate to them what we have learned of Christ. And the last point I want to make this morning, and I hope this opens our eyes to some of the purpose of why God calls us into this opportunity in the first place. He doesn't just call us into parenthood so that we can experience his change in our hearts and so that others can see his change in our hearts. He calls us into parenthood because he has a mission for us as parents, a mission for us to accomplish for him. Not only is he accomplishing something in us, we're accomplishing something for him. And I think this is just, it's incredible. It's exciting. Now Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria, was a great and honorable man in the eyes of his master because by him the Lord had given victory to Syria. He was also a mighty man of valor, but a leper. And the Syrians had gone out on raids and had brought back captive a young girl from the land of Israel. And she waited on Naaman's wife. And she said to her mistress, "If only my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria, for he would heal him of his leprosy." And Naaman went in and told his master, saying, "Thus and thus said the girl who is from the land of Israel." And so the king of Syria said, "Go now, and I will send a letter to the king of Israel." And he departed and took with him a huge financial gift. And he brought the letter to the king of Israel. Said, "Be advised when this letter comes to you that I've sent Naaman, my servant, who's been beating up on you people for some time, that you may heal him of his leprosy." Now, how are you going to feel about this as the king of Israel? You know, the king of Israel read the letter, tore his clothes, and says, "Am I God to kill and make alive that this man sends a man to me to heal him of his leprosy? Therefore, please consider and see how he seeks a quarrel with me." And so it was, when Elisha, the man of God, heard the king of Israel had torn his clothes, he sent to the king saying, "Why have you torn your clothes?" It's your lack of belief in God all along that is why he's using Naaman and the Syrian army to kind of inflict the nation of Israel as it is. He's trying to get your attention, and now Naaman has got leprosy, and his king sends him to you for healing, and you haven't got sense enough just to send him to me? You're there grieving and tearing your clothes. "Oh, the king of Syria is trying to pick a fight with me. Look! Look, I've been trying to show you God all along." And he says, "Am I God to kill and make alive?" And Elisha's like, "No, but I work for him." Like, what is your problem? Just send him to me. Why have you torn your clothes? Let him come and see me, and he'll know there's a prophet in Israel. Same thing I've been trying to tell you. And Naaman went with his horses and chariot and stood at the door of Elisha's house. And Elisha sent a messenger. This guy doesn't even get God's messenger. He gets the messenger of God's messenger. Elisha sends a messenger to him saying, go and wash in the Jordan 7 times. And Naaman became furious and went away and said, indeed, I said to myself, he will come out and stand and call on the name of Jehovah his God and wave his hand over the place and heal the leprosy. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean? So he turned and went away in a rage. And his servants came near and spoke to him and said, my father, if the prophet had told you to do something great, would you not have done it? It's not the 7 labors of Hercules, it's 7 short baths. You know, just take a bath. How much more if he just says, wash and be clean? So he went down and dipped 7 times in the Jordan, according to the saying of the man of God, and his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. And he returned to the man of God, he and all his aides, and came and stood before him. And he said, indeed, now I know there is no God in all the earth except in Israel. How many powerful adult men are in this story? Naaman, his king, king of Israel. Elisha, his messenger. Naaman's servants. Naaman's servants have the guts to call him out. My father, if the prophet had told you to do something great, would you not have done it? How much more if he just says, wash and be clean? His servants are influential enough, they can turn his mind. When he has already, as it says here, went away in a rage. Right? So there are no weak people in this story. And obviously, if you're following my train of thought at all, you're seeing directly where this is going already. So there's really not a lot of suspense. You know, suspense is good when you're speaking. Build some suspense. But there isn't any. All right? If only Naaman could go to the prophet that's in Samaria. Right? The person who sets this in motion is a slave girl. Right? Who is from the land of Israel, who was not taught the worship of Jehovah and the glory of Jehovah's prophet because that was the prevailing social climate. It wasn't. Parenthood is an opportunity to change the world. This servant girl knew of the Lord and knew of his prophet because of her parents. It was not the prevailing social climate. Elijah had said, choose this day, not unlike Joshua had said. He says, choose this day, you know. If Baal be God, follow him. If Jehovah's God, follow him. And the nation continued in its ambivalence, which is why he felt so like such a failure in his mission. The nation continued in its ambivalence, and largely you were going to inherit the religion of your parents because the prevailing social climate was so ambivalent. Man, worship whatever. But given the legacy of Ahab and Jezebel, if you're going to worship Jehovah, maybe be careful on how you do that. You know? This little girl is in a foreign land proclaiming that there is a God in Israel and there is a prophet in Samaria. Now, how overly cautious does that seem to you? Right? This is a kid with faith and a kid with guts. And I can just about, if you know, even just a basic glance at the historical context in which she lives, this is a girl with faith and guts, and she got it from her folks. Parenthood is an opportunity to experience God's change in you. Parenthood is an opportunity to demonstrate what God can change in a person. And parenthood is an opportunity to change the world. And there are certain phrases, I don't know if it's Western civilization, I don't know if it's America, I don't know if it's postmodern America, but there are certain phrases we like to use, and they're like, they're argument enders, right? We have phrases like, true love. Doesn't matter if you can define it. It just ends the discussion. It's like a highest ideal. And therefore, it becomes almost meaningless. Well, I realize that change the world is another one of those things. It's another one of those things. It's a phrase. It doesn't carry a defined meaning because we all define it in our own way. We just all accept somehow that it's part of our mythos. We believe, as Americans in the first world country and in the 20th and 21st century, we believe in the phrase, change the world. We believe in that phrase even if we can't define it or even if we would all define it differently. You see what I'm saying? This is part of our collective ideal. We say that this or that will change the world. This or that can change the world. And we don't even necessarily have a way to define that. But I'm going to tell you, parenthood is an opportunity to change the world. How do you change the world? It's one heart at a time.
And what if you were to change two hearts? And what if they were to change two hearts? Parenthood is an opportunity to change the world. Parenthood is, in addition to your Christian witness, the way to change the world. After all, in parenthood, you have some little human units around you who will see your Christian witness more clearly than anybody else. They will always hear what you shouldn't have said and always see what you shouldn't have done. And that is one of the ways God uses them to change you. They are a mirror of self-reflection constantly. And sometimes you can rush into your day as a parent and not begin it by looking into the mirror of the Word. You miss God on the way to caring for your children. And if you're not listening to Him in His Word, He'll talk to you through your kids. You will not escape what He wants to change in you because His ideas are so wonderful, right, that He will get them through to you. And parenthood is an opportunity to be changed. It's an opportunity for the people around you to see how you have changed. And it is, truthfully and literally, a way to impact the world around you, all right, like a cue ball on the break. The influence you have in your children's lives, in the lives of their friends, in the lives of their friends' parents, all right, all of those things exist because you have those children, all right? Don't take any kids. Just come down to the Y on Saturday mornings and hang out at T-ball games. Don't bring any kids. Just lurk. All right? Excuse me, sir. All right? You know, you have that opportunity because you have children. You can't just go down there and hang out. It's weird. All right? If you have children, you go to T-ball because your children are in T-ball. T-ball doesn't have spectators, you know? It is highly entertaining, nonetheless, but T-ball doesn't have spectators, you know? Like, you have incredible opportunities to influence your children and the world your children will live in because you have them, all right? Because you have those children. And parenthood is an opportunity in the context in which your children live and in the hearts by which they live. Parenthood is an opportunity to, day after day, influence the world in which we all live. Parenthood is an opportunity to change the world. The general of the Syrian army said, "I now know that there is no God but in Israel." And why did he say that? Because some runt kid was raised right. So I'd like to ask you one question. Elijah, in the depths of his sorrow over his nation and his feelings of insufficiency in his mission and failure in his mission, as he returns to the land of Israel from his brief exile, who does he meet? Right. He meets Elisha. What's Elisha doing? Elisha's plowing the field, all right? And he calls him to be his servant, and Elisha's the one we're reading about here. You ever wonder who Elisha's parents were? The prevailing social climate of the day is not one of the kind of worship, you know, single-hearted worship of Jehovah that Elisha demonstrates in his life. That is not the prevailing social climate. Where did he get it from? I would suggest to you that probably like Elijah, like the servant girl, all right, Elisha got it from his folks, all right? And here we see Elisha continuing the chain, all right? Folks, parenthood is the chance of a lifetime. You can define greatness however you want. But as Christians, if we are not defining grace and greatness as the image of Christ, we're defining it wrong. That is the definition of greatness, and something else isn't. Right? Greatness is the image of God. Greatness is Christ stamped on us. What is the image of God? We studied that all year last year. Love, joy, peace, gentleness, forbearance. Those things ever come into play as parents? Probably. Probably. Folks, parenthood is the opportunity to arise to greatness. Greatness is the image of Christ. Parenthood is the chance of a lifetime. Father in heaven, we thank you for being our father, for being the parent we all wish we could be. We thank you for your constant care for each one of us. We thank you for your endless wisdom. We thank you for your frequently inexplicable generosity. We thank you for your leadership. We thank you for your constancy. And we pray, Lord, that as parents and indeed as people, We would learn to display these things to the people around us. Lord, we also want to be constant. We want to be wise. We want to lead people to you. We want to be generous. We want to demonstrate your characteristics in all of our relationships. But there are some people who depend on us an awful lot more. And so we pray that as we navigate life, and particularly as we navigate parenthood, that this situation that demands so much of us would be an opportunity to arise to the image of Christ in the relationships that we have with our children and the relationships that we have through the context of having children. We thank you for what an incredible opportunity it is. And so we pray that as parents, as we live and love and grow together and change together, that the change would be in the direction of the image of Christ, and that you would help us to arise to this incredible opportunity to be great people, no matter how small or great we may be. We pray that we would identify clearly in our mind that you are how we define greatness. And we pray, Lord, that in that context, in that way, you would make us great. And make us great parents. Because the stakes are so high. We thank you for giving us our children, and we thank you for making us your children. In Jesus' name, amen.